Welcome to Wildflower Tales, dear listener, the podcast that uncovers hidden gems in literature, written by women authors, some names familiar, and some that should be. I'm your host, Jenny Dallin, and I'm delighted you've joined me today. Podcasts like Classic Tales, Selected Shorts, and Lore inspired me to create this podcast, which shares stories deemed classic literature and was popular fiction of their time written by women. For today's episode, I am serving up some sentimental romance with the three Misses Benedict at Yale from the Carcellini Emerald with Other Tales, first published in 1899. Mrs. Burton Harrison, also known as Constance Carey Harrison, as well as by her nom de plume Refugita, was a prolific American novelist late in the 19th century. She came from a prominent Virginia family, and she, along with two of her cousins, were known as the Carey Invincibles. The three sewed, actually, the first examples of the Confederate battle flag. As a young woman, she witnessed firsthand the American Civil War, nursing Confederate wounded in Manassas and Richmond. After the war, she toured Europe and married Burton Harrison, a lawyer and American politician who actually once served as the private secretary of Confederate President Jefferson Davis. They moved to New York in 1876, and there is when she finally began writing. Her first magazine article was A Little Centennial Lady, which attracted attention, and thereafter she produced more than 50 works, including short stories, articles, essays, children's books, and short plays. She was very active in elite New York society. And a fun fact, among her contributions to American literature, Mrs. Harrison persuaded her friend, Emma Lazarus, to donate a poem to the fundraising effort that was paying for the pedestal for the Statue of Liberty. Yes, Mrs. Harrison is the one who helped give us, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. I know, it makes up a little for the Confederate flag making. Today, I wanted to share something on the lighter side, speaking to young romance and gives us a glimpse of society during the Gilded Age and their social mores. There were a great many of these stories out there, many published in the magazines of the time, when to not be married by 25 was quite spinsterly of us. No pressure. Consider this story today sort of an oral version of a Hallmark movie. So grab a warm beverage and journey with me and Mrs. Burton Harrison back to a time of chaperones, attending balls, wearing elbow-length gloves, and gossiping with friends at afternoon teas were the norm for young college-aged women. The Three Misses Benedict at Yale. A heavy fall of snow upon the old streets of New Haven had not succeeded in blocking the wheels of progress of that merriest season of the collegiate year, known to the university world as prom week. For 3 days, a crowd of fair visitors and their chaperones had trod the round of gaieties, had frequented the concerts, germains, teas, and receptions. They were now drawing breath and gathering energy for the last crucial test of physical endurance, the ball called the Junior Promenade. For, to properly celebrate this time-honored and brilliant affair, custom decrees that the list of 30 or more dances and intermissions printed upon the ball card presented to each damsel crossing the threshold of this hall of rapture shall, long beforehand, have been filled with names by the brother, cousin, or admirer having the list in charge. It follows naturally that by the time not only all these dances are accomplished, but every intermission has been spent in an impromptu dance to the music of the band, alternating with the orchestra, night has brightened into dawn. When the girls are finally induced by their exhausted matrons to withdraw from the giddy whirl, they leave behind a set of men, wild-eyed and wilted as to shirt fronts, cuffs, and collars, but undaunted in spirit. These men, the givers of the ball, then go away to their dormitories to snatch an hour or two of slumber before chapel, which has, not infrequently, been attended by beans and ulsters worn over evening clothes. It was to such tireless devotees rather invigorating than depressing to see snowflakes come trooping down upon the final scenes of their 3 days' gaiety. Toward 9 o'clock p.m., the streets were encumbered by lumbering old hacks pulling up before doors to receive their loads of hooded and cloaked figures, then driving with them at a furious pace to the door of the armory where the prom is given, and dashing off again to secure new fares. The drivers of these vehicles, known by name to most of the students, extend to the university and its doing an almost parental indulgence. To the guests who are aiding to make the occasion brilliant, they are suave beyond imagination, solicitous of comfort, descending from their perches to open the carriage doors, and assisting parlously at the elbow of the lady entering or getting out. Little of the evening's fun is to be theirs, honest fellows, but they are sustained through the chilly vigils of the night by the esprit de corps and a brave desire to keep up the credit of their town. Quite early in the fray, one of these hacks disgorged upon the armory's awning a party consisting of a mother, 2 daughters, and a girl cousin, all 3 of the young women marked with the same general characteristics of family, but differing in feature and degree of beauty. The mother, a stout, comely body with diamond butterflies quivering about the base of a tall, black aigrette that, springing from her hair, swept the carriage top as she sat, emerged with a look denoting resolution to carry on the struggle of spirit against flesh to the bitter end. For was not only her son, her pride and joy, leader of the revels, as the head of the floor committee of the prom? Not for worlds would she have given up the wearing privilege of sitting out the ball. Never in her own palmiest days had she drawn near to a scene of gaiety with a more proud sense of identification than tonight, when she shone in the reflected glory of her handsome boy. Jack Benedict was, on his part, modest, as becomes the truly great, an immense favorite with his class. He had been one of those fellows who sail serenely through college life, winning without apparent effort, honors toiled for by others without success. A good scholar, an athlete of renown, frank, cordial, sympathetic, he was put forward by the vote of his comrades whenever opportunity occurred to represent them before the world, the election to his present post being upon one of these occasions. Fresh-faced, clear-eyed, smiling, dressed in immaculate attire, the tall young hero advanced to meet his mother and, giving her his arm, conducted the party along the length of the long hall to a box fitted up for the friends of the committee of management. The girls following them were immediately surrounded by a throng of men, consulting their dance programs and receiving with pride their compliments upon the charming arrangements of the hall. It had already been decided among the opinion makers that the 3 Misses Benedict were the stars of the festive week, and their approbation of the scene was generally awaited. The vast enclosure of the armory was lined to its arch roof with breadths of semi-transparent stuff, alternatively pale lavender and yellow in tint, giving it a delightfully fresh and blossomy effect. From the ceiling, lighted by veiled electric bulbs, depended a racing shell filled with flowers and a floral football, emblems of the university's late prowess in the athletic world. From high stands on either side of the hall, the band, or else the orchestra, clashed forth unceasingly enlivening strains. Beneath one or the other of those draped eyries were seen to disappear during the progress of the ball, panting and perspiring men who went away wilted after saltatory toil, but returned array in the glory of fresh linen, white collars, and cuffs immaculate. Around the walls, hung with tapestry and plaques of flowers, were ranged the boxes severally sold at auction to the highest bidder among the classmen, who desired thus proudly to extol the ladies of their visiting families and parties. In these dainty nooks were assembled treasures from many a college sitting room. Easy chairs, rugs, lamps, draperies, tables, cushions, above all, cushions, of every size, material, and color, were brought hither by their owners or borrowers from acquiescent friends to make resting places for the chaperones, and when possible, the girls. The wide, crash-covered floor, soon covered with whirling figures, became a dazzling kaleidoscope. The suggestion presented by the sight was one of extraordinary brilliancy and lightness. It was as if the genius of American youth were abroad and at his best. No face there that did not gleam with happiness, no foot that did not spring with rapturous life. Of those encumbrances of an ordinary ballroom, the sad, the sour, the world-weary, the middle-aged, none was discernible. The young men and maidens prominent in this function, gathered from far and near in the broad republic, were types of blended races, or pure Americans such as one may hardly see elsewhere in an Eastern festivity. And the conventional uniformity of a dance in New York, Boston, or Philadelphia was thus most agreeably varied, and through all was apparent to older eyes the joy of living and being that comes only in the first quarter of the century of life. "Are you satisfied with it, Madre?" asked Benedict as he stopped in his evening's toil to bend affectionately over his mother, where she sat in the front of the committee box, her satin and jet rustling in the breeze created by an ostrich feather fan. "Satisfied? Indeed I am. It is a perfectly enchanting scene, and your decorations are really admirable. I never saw such a well-managed dance. But my dearest boy, can't you sit down and take a moment's rest? You will really wear yourself out." "No fear of that. After tonight, we shall all lapse into innocuous desuetude, and there'll be full time to repose. I hope you and the other mothers can hold out. You won't see much of your charges, I'm afraid." "Dear me, no. They only rush back to be pinned or put to rights and are off again. As to keeping the faces, much less the names of their partners in mind, I can't pretend to do it. Agnes and Margaret, being older, take it with more composure. But Lou flies about as if she were on wings instead of high heels." "It was a whim of Agnes and Margaret to come dressed alike in those blue satin gowns with the chiffon ruffles. And I must say they are becoming. I am proud of our dear girls' looks. Aren't you?"
"I should think so," said Jack, starting with something of a blush as she repeated this query.
He had been straining his gaze over the revolving crowd in the effort to identify not his sisters, Lou and Margaret, pretty blonde girls of 18 and 20, but his cousin Agnes, a tall and rather stately young woman, a year older than Margaret, whom he had his own private reasons for not allowing to get far out of his sight or thoughts. Agnes, the orphan daughter of a good-for-nothing cousin of Mr. Benedict's, had a year or two before, after the death of her father, been taken by these kindly people to reside under their roof in New York. When it was Jack had first owned to himself that he loved her, could not exactly say, but her clear, pale beauty, the soft luster of her hazel eyes, her somewhat foreign grace of speech and manner, born of wide wanderings in continental cities, had begun by captivating his imagination and ended by exciting his enthusiastic affection. Now he thought no vision of his future was complete without Agnes installed in its perpetua. And as yet, she had no idea of it. Knowing that his parents would disapprove of lovemaking between the cousins until Jack had at least been long enough out of college to see his way clear to an independence, he had had the rare strength of mind to keep his passion to himself. Not even his mother suspected what a cable had been thrown out to annex her bonny craft to this landing stage for life. One person only had shared in his secret,
and he a classmate bound to Jack by the most intimate of college ties, the man of all others in the university whom Jack most admired and trusted. This was Herbert Russell, who, coming a stranger to Yale from his birthplace in a far western town, had remained an enigma to the many, although treasured by the few who had found him out. Russell was known as a brilliant scholar, but had never been called a grind. His isolation seemed to be a thing of preference. To the society of women, his objection was apparently insuperable. No threshold in the hospitable town had been crossed by him for social purposes. Jack Benedict, who alone seemed to exercise over him the magnetism that drew him from his shell, had often talked to Russell about his own family and had striven without success to induce his friend to visit them in the holidays. Russell had listened with a sort of fascinated reserve to Benedict's happy boyish confidences, but had not responded to them in kind until one evening in junior year over their pipes in Jack's sitting room. Then he had blurted out a sad tale of his father's disgrace and imprisonment and death in the penitentiary, following the embezzlement of trust funds confided to his keeping. This awful chapter had left upon the boy's mind an indelible imprint. To remove the effect of it, his mother had strained every nerve to send him to an Eastern university. At the beginning of freshman year, he had lost his mother too, and since then the spell of darkness had reassumed its sway over Herbert Russell. Benedict, a wholesome, happy fellow, born to no great inheritance of riches, and having his own way to hew in the world's wilderness, then set himself to the task of restoring Russell's tone of mind and of dissipating in him the uncertainty as to his right of place among people of unblemished honor and respectability. Little by little, he had succeeded in bringing about this result. In his zeal to win Russell's full confidence, he had poured out his own, had even told him of his love for the radiant cousin Agnes Benedict, who Jack hoped one day to win for his wife. During the past days of gaiety, Russell had been more miserably shy and reserved than ever. In vain had Jack urged him to call upon or make acquaintance with his family. As a last resort, he had gone to Russell's room that afternoon and had shot into the letter slit upon the knocked door a note enclosing a ticket for the prom, begging Herbert to look in at the ball, if only for a glance in passing at Jack's people in their box. While Jack now stopped to speak to his mother, he saw, with curious elation and surprise, Russell standing a little distance away, talking with one of the tutors. Before he had time to beckon his friend, his sister Louisa and their cousin Agnes hurried together into the box, forsaking each the young man who escorted her, to have some trifling repair to her toilette made by Mrs. Benedict.
"Oh, Jack, I'm too happy for anything, and Agnes should be if she is not, for she has evidently captured the best-looking man in the room, next to you, of course, that tall, dark one over there. He has done nothing but gaze after her in a moony, melancholy way. Why, I am dying to know him. Do fetch him here now and introduce him. There's a dear. Only give me half a chance, and I can make him forget Agnes, I'll promise you."
"That," said Jack, identifying at last the individual she was trying to point out and watching for the effect of his revelation upon his family. "I am not surprised you want to know him. That is my best friend, Herbert Russell."
"Is that Russell?" said the three women in concert. To them, he had long been a household word.
"Yes, and he came here to please me, dear old chap. The trouble is, I don't know whether he'll have the courage to follow it up by being presented to you."
Lou does not know why he was so interested in Agnes. "My Agnes," he added to himself, striving to repress the exultation of his heart as he looked upon her he loved. Jack did not realize that his friend Russell could have any confusion of mind as to which of the three Mrs. Benedict was the cousin honored by preference undeclared. The fact was that Herbert had strayed into the whirl of the prom for indeed nothing but to please his friend.
while making up his mind to take his courage in two hands and seek for an introduction, Russell had espied, standing in a set of dancers, a girl who then and there struck him as his ideal of scarce-acknowledged dreams, a woman's loveliness. So swift yet strong was the impression thus received that Russell gasped and wondered what had come over him. The blood of young manhood surging into his temples showed him in a flash that he was to the full as weak as to those at whom he had often jeered. Jack Benedict, for example, whose ravings over his pretty cousin had often made Russell smile with superiority and amusement. Whatever had been Russell's ambitions and hopes for the future, a woman had had no part in them. And yet, here in the twinkling of an eye, the waving coils of a maiden's loosely bound hair, her airy grace, her supple slender waist and noble shoulders had held him captive. When she turned and he saw her face was as lovely as her form, Russell had actually started to go away. What evil spell had fallen upon him to lure his steps into this place? He resented Jack's influence, secretly objurgated Jack's tiresome lady love and sisters, vowed he must and would return home, and lingered. When the set was over and the girl went off with her partner, Russell, half ashamed, asked the college official who had accosted him if he knew who was the young lady in pale blue with a small wreath of white roses perched sideways upon her hair.
Let me see. Isn't that?
Yes, of course it is. A sister of Benedict's? I met them yesterday at Mrs. Clarkson's tea.
But you ought to know Benedict's people better than I do, Russell.
You know I am a recluse.
Then I advise you to repair neglected opportunities and make their acquaintance on the spot. There's another one, a little jolly laughing girl, and a cousin. Not so good-looking by a long shot, but nice manners and intelligent. Decidedly, Benedict's party has lent luster to the week.
Before Mr. Grampian had finished his chuckling remarks, Russell had melted away from him and stood alone, irresolute. In this attitude, he was overhauled by Benedict, who, breathless, laid a hand upon his shoulder.
Here you are, you old fraud. Come along and be presented to my mother. She is all anxiety to meet you. Expects you to have wings and a harp, from my description. And the girls are, luckily, all in the box for a minute's breathing spell. I call this kind, Russell, for you to turn up here after all, and I'll not forget it in a hurry.
Russell, having no alternative, rushed blindly upon his fate. How could he tell Benedict that he had already, without reason, without excuse, fallen in love with Jack's beautiful sister, and knew that the better part of wisdom was to retire from the fray before matters should get worse? He walked dreamlike beside his friend, when through the ceremony of introduction to Jack's mother, received a kind handshake from Mrs. Benedict, and scarcely venturing to look up, heard Jack say,
"Mr. Russell, my sisters, my cousins, all Miss Benedicts, so you will have no trouble in knowing how to address them."
Jack's voice thrilled with affection for his friend. Russell's fingers clasped in succession three gloved right hands. He knew by intuition when he touched those of the girls whose charm had enthralled him, and looking her full in the eyes, met in return a glance of gentle approbation. "Jack has cried me in their market better than I knew," he thought gratefully. By the immediate departure of the other two young ladies in answer to the strains of the Washington Post, set to a two-step, together with Jack's flight in search of his own partner, Russell found himself for a moment alone with the Miss Benedict he most admired.
"I'm not detaining you?"
"Not at all. In fact, I am stranded upon your hands. My idea is that the man I promised this dance to is fainting somewhere on the outskirts of the crowd. When I saw him last, he was already pumped, and supper not yet served."
"I hope they will not revive him," said Russell, yielding for once the temptation of the hour.
Back of the committee box was a little room set apart for raps and tete-a-tetes, into which he had the hardihood to invite his companion to retire, hoping thus to seclude her from the observation of her tardy dancer.
"Yes, do go. I shan't tell," said Mrs. Benedict, smiling approval. "The little rest will do you good, and I know Jack will think well of your change of comrades."
Thus, everything conspired to bring closer around poor Russell the net he had not sought to weave. Sitting back among the cloaks and hats, with the music floating into them in softened cadence, he could feast his eyes upon the beauty that had ensnared him. Her talk, bright, friendly, unaffected, girlish, was exactly calculated to win him from his habitual attitude of reserve. He found himself pouring out upon her ear the stream of strong original thought and language which had first made Jack Benedict his ardent admirer. She, in turn, felt a sense of pleasure and bedazzlement in this man's society that she had never known before. All Jack had said of Herbert Russell was more than confirmed by her talk with him, and before the brief period of their isolation was ended, something of the same everyday marvel worked upon him by her was accomplished in her gentle breast by him. A tremor of admiration, a preference for his society, ran through her veins. She asked herself timidly, what should she do if she never met him again? Why fate had been so long in granting to her this experience of delight? An invasion of young men, the missing partner full of apologies for the accident of his detention, and the man to whom the next intermission was promised, broke up their tete-a-tete. Russell hardly believed his good fortune when she said in a vexed aside,
"There, now they've spoiled the best of the evening for me. I am sure we shall have no other chance to talk."
"You are going tomorrow?"
"Yes, at 11. I'm so sorry."
"I must see you once more," he said briefly, then drew within himself, frightened at his own audacity. After that, he watched her from afar, not being able to bring himself to join the throng of chatterers who surrounded her in the intervals of dancing or at supper time. Once only, Jack, running upon him, paused under the weight of official cares to say brightly,
"You took to him, then? My people, I mean."
"I should say I did. They are all delightful, and your sister, Jack, is, well..."
"Which sister?"
"I actually don't know, but she wears blue and has a wreath of white roses."
"Ah, that's my sister Margaret. Do you know I always had an idea that you would hit it off with Margaret? She doesn't let herself out to everybody by any means. But, Herbert, you might say one word for my own particular goddess, Agnes, who is the chief woman in the world for me, though I daren't tell her so till I'm further ahead in fortune."
"Agnes? Which is she?" answered Russell confusedly, conscious that he had given thought only to the companion of his talk in the committee room.
"Stupid! There's but one Agnes, as I said, and she wears blue."
He was torn away by an imperative demand for the floor manager, and Russell felt relieved. "I should not like to think to have confessed to him that neither of the others made the least impression upon my sensibility. I saw, of course, that there were two other young females of pleasing but conventional exterior. That was all. Only the blindness of a brother could overlook the fact that Margaret is far and away the most distinguished, individual, high-bred, graceful, gracious of the three. A man who had once spoken to Margaret would seek conversation with the other two only when he had absolutely no chance with Margaret." Russell stayed till daylight, looking in at the armory windows, drove the last dancers to withdraw. Poor Mrs. Benedict, yawning dismally behind the ostrich feather fan, had to confess herself beaten by sheer fatigue. Walking stiffly out upon the arm of her son, she soon fell into the corner of her carriage, thanking heaven that Jack could by no possibility be again the floor manager of a junior prom. All around her, limp figures were seen slinking into retreat. The most indefatigable of the dancers among the men revealed foreheads streaked with matted hair, staring eyes, shirt fronts and collars flaccid for want of starch, buttonhole bouquets like crushed vegetables. upon that stage of annual festivity who were well to let fall a veil. When Russell appeared at the carriage door to aid Jack in putting his family into their vehicle, a faint blush came into the clear, pale cheeks of his companion in the talk of a few hours before.
"Might I, would you take a little stroll with me before you leave?"
Russell ventured with a throbbing heart to ask her.
"Tomorrow? I mean, today?"
"Yes, you see, it is my only chance."
"I'll be waiting in the little reception room of the hotel at 10.
It seemed to her that they were in a boat, being borne onward by the current. Jack and Russell walked together back to their dormitory building, where each man occupied with a roommate a suite of 2 bedrooms and a sitting room. As the gray of the sky warmed with rose color, Jack yawned mightily between 2 puffs at a cigar.
"I'd give a kingdom for a solid 8 hours sleep. But alas, I've got to be up betimes at the station, on duty, putting them in the train, you know. Or I think I'd take cuts enough to tide me over a half a day in bed."
"That is one of those things I can't do for you, or I would. I mean, putting the ladies in the train."
"Why, man, are you made of iron and whalebone that you show not a sign of somnolence?"
"Not in the least. I never so heartily wish that I were constructed after that model as since this evening's experience. But remember that you have danced many miles, while I merely hung around on the outskirts."
"You sound almost gay as a lark. What's come over you?
I advise a ball a week at this rate. Perhaps you are going to come out as a fusser, a regular squire of dames, in your old age."
"No such luck. I have seen but one dame I should care to squire.
And she, well..."
"A confession? But it's never too late to mend, so go ahead."
"I have no story. I am simply the victim of overwhelming circumstances. Love came so unsought, unsent, and it will probably expire when I do. So no more at present from yours, idiotically."
"I know you too well to press inquiries. You will, as usual, just shut your jaw and glare in silence if you don't care to hold forth on any topic."
"I too am ready for silence, though, for a grosser reason."
They kept pace together without speaking until they reached the landing where Jack turned at his door, Russell ascending higher.
"Good night."
"Good day."
"By the way, I forgot to mention that my mother tells me it was Agnes, my Agnes, you know, and not my sister Margaret, with whom he had that chat in the committee room.
Now, I did suppose that even a churlish old batch like you could tell the difference between those two. Margaret's a nice girl, a dear girl. But Agnes, well, you know what I think of Agnes."
"Agnes?"
"Yes, my bride-to-be when I get enough money to claim her. My mother said she as evidently took to you as you did to her. That's as it should be, old chap. When I'm awake, we'll have a jolly long talk over her perfections. Meantime, you evidently need sleep as much as I do. I never saw such a pale face as you've got on you suddenly. Brace up, and goodbye till we meet again."
"Agnes," repeated Russell mechanically as he crept up his flight of stairs and went into his room. Down fell his card castle. The havoc wrought on him by that one short talk must be borne in silence and lived down. It was Jack's lady love that he had coveted. To follow up the advantage, he could not but feel that what he had gained with her would mean treachery to Jack. Rather than betray his friend, he would so cancel his engagement to meet her at 10 o'clock that she, considering him a bore, would not choose to hold speech with him again. He would simply fail to go to her hotel, and cost him what it might, this course were better than undermining Jack. As the hour of her appointment with Herbert Russell passed without sign or token from him, a blush of shame dyed the cheek of Agnes Benedict. She wondered at herself for making this engagement to meet Jack's friend and for feeling ashamed to speak of it to her family. But with a sort of desperate faith in him, she waited in the little reception room at the foot of the hotel stairs where she had promised to be found. When she could wait no longer, she went into her room and burst into tears. Mortified by her want of self-control, she promised herself that Russell would yet explain satisfactorily the slight to her. At the station where Jack finally appeared, arriving at a gallop in a cab just as the train was about to start, she experienced a new pang of disappointment. Not only was Herbert Russell nowhere to be seen, but he had sent no message. Agnes came to the swift, maidenly conclusion that it was because she had cheapened herself by making an appointment to see him alone after but a half hour's acquaintance. She would bear her punishment in silence and tell nobody, Jack least of all. As the days wore on, Agnes felt that something had gone out of her life, something not quite warranted by the briefness of that interlude at the ball. Try as she might, she could not forget Russell and the emotion he had caused in and seemed to feel for her. Jack's letters home spoke of him as winning new honors in the college course. When June came, the family went up again to Yale to hear the speaking for the DeForest Medal, for which both Jack and Russell were to be competitors. It was known that popular opinion inclined to select Jack Benedict as the prize winner, but that Russell was considered a close second. In their zeal for their own hero, the Benedicts were beginning to look a little frigidly upon Jack's opponent, and it is safe to say that all of them, save Agnes, hoped and prayed that Russell might not win. Agnes, who would have given anything for excuse to stay away, found none. The appointed day saw her one of the audience assembled within the walls of the old college chapel, whose prim Puritan interior made even this gala occasion seem a little less cheerful than a funeral elsewhere. She had been standing with her cousins in the corridor as the procession of senior classmen in caps and gowns filed by, and to her utter discomfiture, a momentary halt in the line had brought her face to face with Herbert Russell. In an instant, the blood rushed into her cheeks. Russell, looking her full in the face, saluted her with conventional reserve. In reality, he felt more of an inward excitement than did she. A moment more, and they parted. She to sit gathering her faculties together in one end of the pew to which the Benedicts had been assigned, and trying to believe that she had not cared a bit.
"Did you see that, Mr. Russell? Stiff, cross-looking fellow, spite of Jack's praises. Oh, Agnes, if he and not Jack should win the DeForest, I could never get over it, never. I almost hate him now, don't you?"
"No,"
whispered Agnes, blushing and hesitating.
"You are too angelic. And when anyone can see, Jack cares more for what you think than all the rest of us put together. At any rate, you will own that Herbert Russell's very uncivil. He has never taken the least notice of Jack's family, and considering all Jack has been to him. A man told me it is quite well known there's a cloud over Russell's family, something really dreadful, and that Jack has simply brought everybody to forget it and to treat Russell as if it had never been.
Lou, what Jack has done is grand, and I honor him for it. Who dares judge a man for his sins of his father? If ever anyone showed a high and noble nature in his countenance, it is Herbert Russell.
Ah, don't get excited. The object isn't worth it in my opinion, Agnes. I suppose, though, you and Jack see things with the same eyes nowadays.
Lou, you mustn't. Jack and I are nothing but cousins, dear cousins.
Mrs. Benedict, looking across Margaret, here hushed their whispers. Exercises were already underway. When it was Jack's turn to step upon the platform, and after a courteous bow in his student's gown to the president and judges, to begin his oration, all hearts in the audience warmed to the manly and graceful and straightforward young fellow. His essay, well written, carefully polished, was delivered with excellent judgment, and when he had ended and stepped down amid tremendous applause from his friends and classmen, the general verdict was that he would win the prize. Last upon the list of speakers came Herbert Russell. The rather measured applause bestowed on him as he appeared was warmed up by the individual hand clapping of his friend and predecessor, Jack. Hardly a smile lighted Russell's dark and handsome face as he began. His manner, never prepossessing, seemed now under some spell or chill of indifference. By hazard, The pew in which the Benedicts were placed was well to the front, upon the left-hand side of the speaker. As Russell finally approached his peroration, his glance chanced for a moment to rest upon the glowing, inspiring, appealing countenance of a girl who leaned forward to gaze on him with her whole soul in her eyes. The effect of this was immediate. Casting aside his embarrassment, his indifference, he burst into a fervor of natural eloquence, the like of which had not been heard in that spot that day, or for many a day. To Russell was given the persuasiveness of the speech, the music of the voice, the flow of language, the flexibility of countenance, that combined may give interest to material of less value than was his. When he had finished the brief essay, there was no question among his hearers as to who had spoken best. They yielded him the spontaneous applause that no favor to the individual can simulate. Louder and longer than any other present, applauded honest Jack Benedict, who knew himself outdone.
"Why, Mother, that is not like you," said Jack that evening when he went to take supper with his family at the hotel.
Mrs. Benedict, who had been delivering herself of a rather few bitter criticisms upon the winner of the DeForest, news of the award to Herbert Russell had just been communicated to them by Jack, tried to smile deprecatingly and ended by dropping a few tears.
"I know it, Jack, darling, but it's because you are so much more to us than any Mr. Russell."
"Oh, Mother dear, that's the fortune of war. Russell did it 1,000 times better than I ever could. When you think he has no one, absolutely no human being, to telegraph his success, and I have all of you, you will see that what I have is more than a balance for Herbert's luck today. Poor fellow, I wish he had come here with you. I wish we could say something nice to him," said the good lady, her little fit of ill temper dissipated by native kindness of heart.
"He can't be captured, I'm afraid. He is more queer than ever regarding women since the prom. And that time he let me think he was or had been hopelessly in love and was ashamed of himself for being so. Had he confided in me, I should keep my lips sealed. But no, Herbert Russell lives and must always live, I fear, severely within himself.
A secret love for someone that must govern all his life." Agnes, listening, felt her heart sink in very shame. Since she had heard Russell speak, her fancy for him that had lain dormant had sprung up in full growth and vigor. And now she was told that he whom she loved in secret cared nothing at all for her. That meeting on going into chapel but confirmed her in this conviction. She little knew that a glimpse of her face, it was which had inspired his brilliant effort of oratory. She little knew. After supper in the cool, soft evening air of June, they walked over to the town green, and while Mrs. Benedict and Margaret sat together on a bench talking, Lou strolled in one direction, accompanied by a certain young man who had of late begun to arrest her butterfly attention, where Agnes and Jack took another path. The latter pair talked long and easily together, of the interest shared by them through relationship and intimacy of habit. It was only when Jack began insensibly to glide into the tone of tenderness she had noticed often of late with some alarm that his cousin drew back a little in her friendly attitude.
"Don't, Jack, there's a dear boy. If you only knew how nice you can be when you are sensible."
Jack's reply was a burst of long repressed devotion to which Agnes listened in dismay. She had no idea matters had gone so far and was shocked at this evidence of deep feeling. Very gently, very tenderly, she pleaded with him to give up the idea, and after a long and painful talk, brought herself to the point of avowing that her love was not hers to give. Jack, who knew most of her acquaintances, could not conceive of a rival among them. But the double blow of losing in one day the cherished hopes of two such prizes was more than the poor fellow could meet with equanimity. In their absorption as they walked to and fro, neither observed that Russell, straying out to be alone beneath the starlight within his own swelling emotions, had encountered them, had made a movement toward Agnes, then, seeing the expression of Jack's face, had hurried on with the bitterness of jealousy in his heart
that robs success of all of its charms. Then you care for someone else?
Jack, don't. Please.
But I must know.
Yes, but he does not care for me.
All of Jack's manhood answered to this pitiful confession. He spoke to her gently, soothingly, laid her hand in his arm, and told her he would always watch over her like a brother. And Agnes, reassured, looked up in his face with loving gratitude. At this point, Russell, on the return, again passed them. A single glance at the couple convinced him that Jack had won a prize dearer far than the one his friend had that day wrested from him. "It was a miserable delusion of my vanity," Russell said within himself, "that made me answer to the inspiration of her gaze. It is Jack, the fortunate, pet of destiny, who has claimed to her. Here endeth the chapter of my folly." And with gloom in his heart, he went back into his lonely room and life.
3 years after the brief episode of Herbert Russell's two meetings with Agnes Benedict, he found himself enjoying a hard-earned holiday in camp on an island in Georgian Bay. Since graduating, he had made a quick climb up the ladder of success. A series of fortunate circumstances had enabled him to conquer difficulties apparently insuperable. His residence in a progressive town of the Middle West, congenial occupation, and the sense of work well bestowed had done much to restore the healthy tone of his mind, biased to melancholy through another's crime. He had corresponded intermittently with Jack Benedict, but without touching upon the subject of Jack's domestic or sentimental ties. He had read in the society columns of certain New York newspapers of various occasions upon which the three Mrs. Benedict had appeared before the world, of their summers abroad and at home, of the marriage of Margaret, and recently of the more than amateur achievement of Agnes as the artist of some pastels displayed at an exhibition in the spring. What he had expected to read, the announcement of her marriage with her cousin Jack, had not yet reached Russell's eyes. When that event should occur, and not till then, Russell said to himself he would give up, once and for all, the haunting witchery of Agnes Benedict's fair face. Through the mist of 3 years of memory, it shone upon him still. One day in August, a little pleasure yacht of light draft and dainty build met to thread her way between innumerable rocky islands and dally beside tempting bits of shore rather than to brave the rough water of the open bay, passed into an inlet where its owner had decided to throw a rope over a large rock and stop to lunch. This primitive method of anchorage was a favorite one with the owners of the Juanita, the Cartwrights, a benevolent elderly couple from New York, who, owning a summer residence upon one of the islands lower down the bay, often took their house parties away for days of pleasuring afloat. Mr. and Mrs. Cartwright had now as their guest several young men and maidens, among them Jack Benedict, his sister Louisa, and his cousin Agnes. All day, the Juanita had run through narrow channels of pale green water between rocky ramparts crowned with spruce and birch, around the gray flanks of which sprang from the water forests of bulrushes, sprinkled with cardinal flowers and water lilies. As they now steered skillfully into the channel, in which it was expected to find their usual landing place open to approach, an expression of disappointment arose from the forward deck, were gathered a little group of voyagers in the gay attire of summer on the wave. "A camp of men, horrid things! Why did they choose our island?" A rough houseboat anchored near the shore formed the center of supplies for the camp, often replenished by a tri-weekly steam launch from the mainland. Around a fire built upon stones, a party of young men were making rather bored preparations for the midday meal. As the whistle of the toy yacht sounded a salute, they rose to their feet and came hurrying down to the water's edge, evidently not displeased at the invasion of their privacy. "Herbert Russell! Who would have dreamed of our meeting here?" Greetings of introduction followed, and from this point, no expression was heard from the girls of disapproval of those horrid men. It was, in truth, a stalwart and good-looking band, of which Russell was the leader. Mr. and Mrs. Cartwright, nominally joining forces with them for luncheon, brought joy to the hearts of these weary cooks and bottle washers
by the unpacking of a dainty meal well served by the yacht's cook and stewards. As the party grouped itself under the shade of glimmering birches, Russell, as if through a mockery of fate, found himself next to the lady of his dreams. The talk, at first general, subsided into chat between persons sitting at a picnic casually, side by side. Russell, almost fearing to continue where he was, looked over the circle to see Jack Benedict half reclining on the moss at the feet of an extremely pretty girl in white duck, a sailor hat tied down with a white veil half covering her face. Seeing him thus provided for, Russell had less scruple in accepting his own half hour of joy. He thought Agnes sweeter, more womanly, more to his taste than ever. The rare experience was his of finding oneself confirmed in a predilection after 3 years of total separation from the object. They talked easily, without reference to the past, without touching upon intimate topics. He fancied, without being sure, that Agnes knew the incidents of his advance since leaving college. That she had thus kept track of him was a flattery he must accept only because he was Jack's friend. When he left her, his pulses bounding with delight of her presence. Jack Benedict took him off to the roof of the yacht's deck, where they sat by the pilot house and smoked and chatted through a long and lazy hour. During this time, the rest of the party had scattered for various enterprises, exploring the waters in canoes, fishing, reading novels under the deck awning, or lounging beneath the trees and overhanging rocks. And as yet, no word had passed Jack's lips concerning his sentimental relations with the sex. Suddenly, Mrs. Cartwright's voice called up to him.
"Mr. Benedict, won't you please take a canoe and paddle up that inlet yonder in search of your cousin and Miss Clare? We shall be starting before long, and I must begin to gather my chickens under my wings."
Jack blushed as he prepared to obey the chaperone's behest. "You will think that for an engaged man I'm rather forgetful of my treasure. I meant to tell you, Russell, that I'm to be married in October." Russell's heart gave a despairing leap. Wasn't it to be expected?
"Well, there were reasons I couldn't bring myself to write to you, old chap. And perhaps we need not discuss it further, but I'm happier than I deserve to be, and I have won a gem of purest ray," said Jack as he dropped lightly into the canvas canoe, a deckhead and put into the water, Russell following. As they paddled rapidly around the sharp projection of rocks that it seemed to block the way ahead of them, they saw the girl's canoe in the center of a field of lily pads bordering another one of the rocky points, here so numerous in the channel. When the lily gatherers, who had half filled their craft with masses of gleaming flowers and long curling stems, espied the search party, they waved them a merry welcome. "I knew they were not fishing. She's too tender-hearted by far," exclaimed Jack with a lover's pride. Simultaneously, the smiles vanished from his handsome face. A naphtha launch was just then passing into this inlet, had left behind it a swell that made the canoe containing the two girls rock perilously from side to side. Agnes, evidently recognizing the danger, sat quite still, but Edith Clare threw herself forward with a scream and clasped her companion in her arms. The canoe, upsetting, plunged both occupants into the broadleaf greenery, under which they sank at once out of sight.
"Can they swim?" asked Russell, quickening his stroke.
"Yes, both of them, if they're not caught below." Their canoe shot madly forward. Prompt as were the people in the naphtha launch in turning back to attempt rescue, they could not vie with these men in their eager effort to reach the scene of the disaster. It was soon evident that while one of the young women had arisen to the surface and was keeping herself afloat, something had happened to prevent the reappearance of the other. Jack was not so quick as Herbert Russell to see that it was Agnes who was missing. With misery clutching at his heartstrings, Russell said entreatingly,
"Let me save her for you, Jack. It will be something to pay back all you've done for me if I can put the woman I've loved ever since I first laid eyes on her into your arms again."
He could not see that Jack was not even looking toward the place where Agnes had gone down. All his thoughts were directed to the spots whence Edith Clare called out to him to save her.
"Coming, my darling, have no fear."
Russell, without an instant's further delay, dived underboard. The canoe, violently shaken, was yet steadied by the other occupant, who succeeded in reaching Edith and extricating her in safety from her perilous surroundings. An anxious interval, and Russell reappeared, bringing with him the sodden form of Agnes, who, snared and held underwater by the green serpents of the lily stems, was quite inanimate. They got her aboard the launch and hurried back to the yacht, where poor Mrs. Cartwright received them, wringing her hands over this sad ending of her day of pleasure. During the hour while Russell waited in an agony of fear on deck, Jack Benedict, who stood beside him, became for the first time aware of his friend's long ordeal of repressed feelings for Agnes.
"And I might have spared you so much of it. It was my fault. I only was to blame. Ages ago I had known this. I might have told you how she gently and tenderly, poor soul, but with finality, put a stop to my boy's dream of winning her. Now, when God only knows whether she'll be with us in the future, I can say no more. I think, Herbert, mind, I can't say I'm sure, but I think she must have loved you from the start."
Russell could not speak. He wrung Benedict's hand, looking at him with hollowed, haggard eyes. "So many people have known for the last 2 years of my attentions to Edith Clare. We've been so frequently announced by our friends to be engaged that even before the engagement was a fact, it did not occur to me that you, though living so far from us, were in total ignorance of our relations. You see, Herbert, that Edith is my other self. My fancy for Agnes grew up with me, but the love for Edith came with my mature manhood. Our engagement was announced only just before we all came off here to visit Mrs. Cartwright, or I should have written to inform you of it officially, and of my approaching marriage."
"There!" exclaimed Russell, who was straining his ears to hear sounds from the little inner cabin where Agnes lay under the care of Mrs. Cartwright and a doctor, found fortunately among the campers on the island.
"I'm sure I hear her voice." Jack's sister Lou came out to them, her face beaming with delight.
"She has stirred, has spoken. She breathes easily now. In a little while, the doctor says she'll be herself again," Lou tried to add, but was choked by her excitement.
An hour or two later, Russell, who had been invited by their hostess to go back with them for a little visit to her island villa, sat beside the lounging chair of Indian bamboo, heaped with rugs and cushions, in which they had placed Agnes upon deck, clad for the occasion in things they always carried aboard in a wardrobe assembled for such emergencies. The yacht was speeding merrily homeward over a track of westering sunshine. Forest fires upon the small islands along their route glowed like jewels upon canopies of dense, pearly smoke. In the wake of the boat, violet shadows appeared and vanished into the water. All ahead of the two was bright as the promised land. What had so long seemed impossible to these lovers had come about in the simplest fashion. Their hands meeting had conveyed the joy of each at reunion with the other. A few broken words from Russell told Agnes that he had no dearer wish than to win her love. And Agnes, now she was pouring out to him the confidences of the 3 years past, was claiming his in return, was hanging upon his words, her face so full of happiness as to tell its own story. "We are all avoiding that part of the deck as if it were a region of pestilence. I don't think I've ever saw such barefaced lovemaking in public. I've had to put up a parasol so not to see them. As for you and Jack, Edith, you may step down from your pedestal as fiancés, although Mama will be very much taken by surprise to hear that Agnes has come up into these remote waters to annex a young man from off an island. I think Jack will induce her to feel resigned. Certainly Russell is a fine, manly fellow. From all I can see, I fancy there will soon be only one Miss Benedict.
Lou, and for how long will there even be one?"
Lou blushed and would not answer. The end. And so ends the tale, The Three Mrs. Benedict at Yale. I hope you enjoyed this story as much as I did. Please let me know, because I'm happy to share more in this romantic bent. I find them really fun.
For more information about Constance Carey Harrison and her works, please check out the show notes. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Wildflower Tales. Please subscribe for upcoming episodes where we will uncover more hidden treasures from women of literature. Until next time, this is your host, Jenny Dallin, signing off. And just like wildflowers, may you thrive in unexpected places.